I'd like to ask all four speakers to come up here, just in case Tony wants to interact with you, if you would take a seat up here. And I'm going to ask Provost Massey to come and make comments on this very rich conversation that we've had. Thank you.
Sitting in the back, very attentively listening to these the talks and the questions, and they've all been very interesting, and they raise for us a lot of questions about what we're going to do at McGill. I've been asked to offer some reflections on both the topics covered and the way in which the panelists have, or the individual speakers now assembled as a panel, have actually presented the material. First, I want to thank Colleen Cook, and I think by reflection, Chris Manfredi, for having helped put this together, spearheading this initiative and bringing these issues and this fine group of speakers to McGill for our careful attention. I want to talk a little bit about McGill and McGill's own efforts for a moment. We think that there has been, and again, I'll speak as me, thinks that there has been a very important shift in the way in which research is conducted and our expectations about the way in which we're going to maintain the record of that research and then its implications for our library. The second thing is that librarianship is a very fast-changing profession. We heard some reflections on that, but we have to begin to completely reimagine our libraries. That's going to be a fundamental piece of the future for McGill, is thinking not only about its physical spaces, but the role that it plays in our lives. We have not done as good a job as we all should in preparing our professors for the changing expectations that students have. I don't know if digital technologies and the way in which students interact with them will fundamentally change the way in which people learn. But I do know that people come here with expectations. Our students have expectations about the role that these things will play in their lives, and they expect us at least to be able to interact with them on that plane. So we have to be careful, not because if people think things are real, then they have real consequences. And we have to really be careful about how our professors are prepared to deal with these things. Our information systems and technologies have now are dated. We were one of the first on the block to do the major innovations, and now 15 years later, we have to think about our IT infrastructure and the way in which it supports us. And last, we can't do this alone, and that's why it's nice to hear of the activities that are going on collaboratively among librarians and among scholars elsewhere in terms of the production of new information and the partnerships that have to evolve. Let me just start with I'll take the speakers in series and just see if we have some potential comments. I thought Larry gave us a really nice introduction to the general problems associated with libraries and the way in which we think about this new revolution. I thought he framed it quite well, from writing to codecs to printing to the internet. This is citing another librarian, but this is an important consideration for us, that this is a revolution we are living through and we cannot ignore it. Think about newspapers. The last speaker spoke a little bit, Clifford spoke a little bit about newspapers. A decade ago, the Boston Globe was a $1 billion industry. Today, it's a vanity press. It really doesn't serve the role that it once served in the community and in the country, because they ignored the digital revolution that was sweeping the newspaper industry. And universities risk a similar fate if we don't come to grips with the way in which the digital revolution is, in fact, affecting the production of scholarship, the way in which we interact with it, and the expectations that our students have for learning. So I think there's a very important consideration that we heard, but we also saw the enormous importance of physical spaces and the ways in which they can be transformed. The photographs were lovely, but they actually are telling us something about what we at McGill are not doing and need to do. So reimagining the library in the way in which the University of Toronto has done is a really important thing. I came to McGill 36 years ago, and I was absolutely astounded at how we had allowed our library to deteriorate. We've tried to catch up in the last 15 years, but you'll never catch up to a university that never abandoned it. And I think Toronto really deserves to be congratulated for the way in which they've handled libraries and librarianship and collections and responsibility, even in the face of increasing budget constraints. So they've done a great job. But how we deal with those spaces and how we deal with retrieval and of information are really important questions, and I'd like to hear more on those reflections in a moment. Chris gave us starting with a very personal reflection, but gave us a very interesting insight into the way in which the profession and the skill sets associated with the profession are changing. I've been arguing with librarians at McGill for a decade about the fact that their profession is the fastest changing one on our campus. It needs to be up to date. We need to make sure our librarians are up to date, that the training they get in the School of Information Studies reflects the nature of that profession, and that it can be best served by an increasing diversity in the pathways that people use to get to the profession. So if you think about the physical spaces, as we heard from Larry, and if you think about what Chris said about the nature of the profession, libraries are now, and they have been for a while, but now they're finally being recognized as absolutely central to the university's future. And we have to think about it more carefully along those lines. I think that Harriet's presentation, really one quote that I wrote down from it, transition of long form and presentation of evidence that is multimedia. The transition from that long form narrative into new expectations about the way in which we can interact with materials. It's interactive. It is changing the way in which we think. It's changing the way in which we work. I still think we have a long way to go in the way in which we have e-books. One of my frustrations is I can't just cut and paste because they limit the amount of material you can copy. But you'd like to cut and paste, for example, bibliographies. Create your bibliographies from your e-volumes, which is much easier, should be, to facilitate research. But the fact is, what is richer about what we're doing now is exactly as Harriet described it. Things that once were flat on a page are now multimedia, and they take us in different ways. And I think the pathways that we follow are really very important. So that's a great insight into how we are transitioning from one way of thinking to another. This is, back to Larry's point, potentially a fifth version of that revolution. It's not just the internet and the World Wide Web. It's the way in which materials can be published, produced, and interacted with directly. Clifford gave us a really interesting insight into the conceptual changes that have not yet actually occurred and that are likely to occur. In fact, I don't know how many of you actually caught this. How many of you know the word that he used, agita? What does it mean? Right. Okay. It's actually really interesting. I don't know how many other people heard that word because he said it very quickly. But it really does. It comes from two things. It's either agitare in Italian, which means to be agitated, or a slurring of the word acid from Italian, meaning you got stomach ache thinking about it. So I wasn't so clear how much of Clifford's agita was either agitation about it or just stomach acid, because he was so concerned about some of the issues. But he raised another whole series of questions, which is probably for another topic, which is about the way in which scholarly materials are now being, or were expected to comply with copyrighted expectations. And we're dealing with companies in that who have been around for a long time. I use one example. I know it's all the librarians know this is not exactly correct, but Elsevier was Galileo's publisher. So if you think about how long they've been in the publishing business, and I say that's the name, Elsevier, they were out of business for a couple of hundred years, but they were around, and they have experience with this, and they have a good thing going with the way in which we produce our scholarship. So we have to think about ways in which we can actually manage issues of copyright and copyrighted materials. So let me just start with some questions for the panelists. We're looking at our physical spaces. What's the feasibility studies that we're undertaking require some of the thoughts that have gone into either robotization or retrieval materials that are automated or digital repositories or physical repositories that are distant from the campus. What are the trade-offs that we'd have to consider as we do that? As we think about our librarians and the way we recruit librarians to McGill, what are the things that we should be thinking about in terms of getting the diversity that Chris mentioned? In terms of digital and copyright compliance issues, what should be on our minds as we move to that, to those things? As we think about librarianship and as we think about the rich ways in which designers are having an impact on the way in which materials are published, who are the partners that we should be working with? It's not just the producers of research, but also the pedagogues and how we might do that, but what are the things we should consider? Another question that I thought was in terms of the way in which students' expectations are changing, how can we help our professors to be better at meeting some of those expectations and helping our professors help students understand that not everything that they want is necessarily a good thing. So I'm going to stop there and see if the panelists have any reflections on those questions.
Do we have until 5 o'clock?
No, you've got 5 minutes, I think is what we have.
You know, I'll take up the because I dodged the question about the balance between digital and print collections in the beginning by saying it depends and I don't know. And I'll stick with parts of that. It does depend. But I think that as having just arrived at a new institution that has a different mix and a mix of disciplines and a different culture, than the one I came from, you know, I'm very aware of how much it depends. But I think, and it depends on lots of things. There's some actual geographical factors that matter deeply. So I'm now at MIT, which exists in an area that is full of great institutes of higher learning, right? I mean, there's, you know, a pretty decent private school also in Cambridge. There are other universities, nearby. So MIT's ability to put physical items in storage and retrieve them from nearby other institutions and even allow our scholars to visit those other institutions and use those collections, you know, that's much easier than when I was at Stanford. And frankly, our nearest peer institution was the large public one across the bay. And they were part of the University of California system. So we were sort of Stanford was sort of the stepchild and didn't, so collaboration was difficult. So those factors matter. They matter very much in terms of making decisions. So I think that on a sort of specific, specifically to the question about what physical items do you keep on campus, because that, for every institution that I know of, on-campus space for physical collections is at a premium. I mean, that is precious space. And so you have to make very careful decisions there. And I think that those many places are making the decisions based primarily on use. And I agree with Cliff that I think that deciding that something that hasn't been used is not valuable is the wrong way to go. I think that some of the criteria need to be how quickly does it need to be accessed and how quickly can it be accessed. And so, again, the geography and your partnerships with other places and where your offsite storage is and how quickly you can retrieve it from there. So, you know, things that are reference-like materials probably ought to stay and are only available in print probably ought to stay on a main campus so that people can get to them quickly when they need them and be done with them. I also think that preservation is a concern. So things that are that need to be in good preservation environments because they're rare and unique materials often are off-site. Storage facilities have provide that better than others. And then there's this issue about, is it an item, is it a set of items that benefits from being physically browsed? And I don't have a good shorthand for describing that, the browsability of collections. And I think our challenge is, so I think that things that benefit from being physically browsed ought to stay on campus. I think that what those are is hard to determine. There are no easy variables by which to decide that. I think some of the factors that weigh into that is, you know, are they items that are likely to have lots of non-textual materials? So images, you know, books that have a lot of images in them, those don't scan well. Books that have maps, books that have mathematical and chemical formulas, you can't search on those. So having those on campus might make sense, depending, again, on the mix of disciplines and use on your campus. Also, things that are that sort of go together as a series and that sort of represent sort of our social and cultural history. So at Stanford, we ended up, because of a real need from voiced by faculty and students, bringing back the long print run, even though it's online, of Life magazine and putting it, because we had a lot of people doing cultural history analysis. And the best way to do that is not to search the online archive of Life magazine, which doesn't necessarily have the ads and the pictures and certainly doesn't have it placed the way that it is in the physical volume. But those are the hard questions. You know, it's easier to look at a spreadsheet and say if it's this old and it hasn't circulated in this many years, mm-hmm. then we should send it off campus. The harder questions and the questions that we as librarians need the support and the collaboration of faculty to help us think through those about how materials are used on a particular campus in particular disciplines and in particular departments. Those are, you know, that's where I think the questions get tricky, and that's where I think we get good, interesting answers.
So I'll just jump in quickly. I would agree with everything Chris said.
That's smart.
You know, I think very smart. So I think in Canada, though, we really need to look at developing, as I said, bigger, better partnerships among the U15 or McGill, Toronto, Alberta, UBC, Montreal. We really need to tackle some of these issues together. So I think, for example, as I said, and our humanities chairs agreed with me, that there are ways we can use technology to facilitate serendipitous discovery and browsing. But I don't think the University of Toronto can do that by itself, or our five institutions in Ontario. I also, you know, wonder, how many copies do we actually need to maintain in Canada of certain materials. And so I think we need to sort of overcome some of our institutional competition, which is healthy in many ways, but in order to do some of that collectively. I'd also like to actually go back to the question that was raised about open access and the issue of small journals to make sure that all of you are aware. So many of us have been concerned, and I used to actually have a press, a medium-sized university press reported to me, so I understand the serious economic issues, the business issues related to publishing in the humanities and the social sciences these days. But many of us have been concerned about how do we sustain in Canada Canadian journals in the humanities and the social sciences that operate on a shoestring budget, that often are already subsidized by their universities, and the universities don't want to add to that subsidy. How do we, the research libraries, help support those publishers? And there is now a short proposal that has actually come out of the libraries at Ottawa, but has been supported by every single member, I believe every member of the Canadian Association of Research Libraries, to get some money to work with the Canadian Association of Learned Journals to see if we can develop new business models for these small Canadian humanities and social sciences journals that don't have large subscription bases outside of Canada, that really don't generate usually even enough revenue to cover their costs, or if they do, they barely do. As I think you probably all know, the tri-agencies last week or 2 weeks ago have now mandated open access for any tri-agency supported research in Canada. And many of the journals are threatened by that. And so I think there are ways that the libraries can work with them. We can provide the technology infrastructure in the university libraries across Canada so that they don't bear that cost. We can actually probably help them with their subscription costs for subscribing outside of Canada, because the open access mandate is actually within Canada. They're a variety, and I don't want to actually develop a business model here, because I think we have to actually talk to the journal publishers about that, and that's the idea of the short grant. But I'm actually very optimistic that within the next year we can actually do something among Canadian research libraries and the Canadian Association of Learned Journals, who's been very engaged with the library community in actually figuring out how do we actually make sure that open access doesn't harm scholarship but actually supports it. And, of course, part of the point of open access is actually, and there's lots of evidence of this, that once research information is open and available, it actually more rapidly builds knowledge. So people build on other people's knowledge if they have access, and if research is not hidden behind paywalls and is dark to a Google search, as I like to say.
So I'll just say a few words about your question regarding how do we begin to understand where students are and also how we share the experience and expertise that we have with our students. One of the interesting things at Brown, I a couple of years ago chaired an online teaching and learning committee. And so part of that discussion involved my going to a number of student functions and gatherings. And they were almost uniformly opposed to having online classes at Brown. And I think that as we began to break down that conversation of what does online teaching involve, they soon realized that, in fact, they were doing a lot of these elements already, but they didn't call it by the same name. They also really didn't want a fully online course as a substitute for interpersonal interaction and so on. I think the same thing if faculty begin to look at the methods that they are using, and especially if we consider the different methods that are used across the disciplines, that many faculty would actually begin to realize that they do already incorporate a lot of digital skills or methods in their own research. Another opportunity, I think, is to have faculty come together to talk about their research, and that is both local faculty as well as inviting others. So there is an international society of online teaching and learning, and you know, at many of these associations of whether it's American Historical Society or AMS, there are many instances where faculty talk about the different styles of scholarship that they do. So I think continuing to have conversations, after all, this symposium was not about 2015, but it really about 2050, as I recall. Mm-hmm. So the question in regard to faculty working with students, I think the learning goes both ways, or at least could go both ways. We're not necessarily just teaching students because that's the way they want to learn, but it's also the way in which the society and the world around us is evolving and changing. So I think the responsibility is not just to continue to hold what we know and what we have learned to be of value, but to consider the alternatives as well. I think one of the great opportunities that we've experienced in libraries and also in classrooms at Brown is involving students in fundamental research side by side with faculty, so that the faculty may promote the idea, the concept, and the student then embodies that in whatever manner with guidance of faculty, of course. And this is where I think we get a lot of really innovative approaches to scholarship, as well as from the faculty themselves. You probably are fully aware of this, but in many instances, it is actually the senior faculty who are doing the most creative, innovative kind of digital scholarship, in part because they don't have to be worried about tenure and promotion.
I'm just going to make, I think a number of the issues have been well covered. I think I just want to inject here a note that as I think the conversations at this symposium have illustrated very well, there is an ongoing need for a set of discussions that really go across all the disciplines, go beyond the institution, and really connect up with broad institutional strategy. These include a mix of things around scholarly communication, research data management, the construction and dissemination of educational resources, which is something we really didn't touch on much today. But this is an area that's really getting shaken up, and institutions are going to need to make some thoughtful decisions here over the next 5 or 10 years. There's a piece of this that also deals with interactions into the broader world. Your alums, for example, your role as an educational center within the broader society. And it seems to me that one of the roles that libraries are taking on, which is really important, is as a kind of a neutral ground and convening function for this. I mean, many of the ultimate decisions here, of course, rest with the faculty and with the institutional leadership. The library is only, to some extent, a facilitator and an implementing tool for certain kinds of decisions. But it's really important that those conversations happen. And my sense is that most institutions aren't really well organized for that, and that a very important role for the library now is as a sort of a convener and a place for those conversations to happen.
Well, go ahead.
I'd just like to quickly go back to the issue of sort of close reading and analysis, particularly in the humanities versus what has become known as digital scholarship, which I think often gets mixed up in people's minds maybe with just text mining or that sort of thing. I actually think that libraries can develop tools that enable that kind of close reading analysis in new and different ways. So to think about the McLuhan example I used, To be able to actually bring together his marginalia, his annotations of 6,000 books, and to understand how he developed one of his theories is actually possible. But in just using those books manually, it would take a lifetime. We can develop tools, I believe, that allows a scholar to pull out 100 annotations he wrote that led then to some of his critical theories, and to then look at those very, very closely. So it is actually a merger of technology with very traditional forms of humanities scholarship. I think the medievalists are actually doing this. So the ability to now, well, to build tools as a number of institutions are looking at, or libraries, to pull out the vernacular writings of a scribe who worked over a 30-year period, writing many books of hours, but inserted vernacular writings in those books of hours, to pull out that scribe, to use handwriting recognition software to actually understand that it is the same scribe, and then to be able to compare the evolution of his ideas or her ideas, but it was probably a he, as they were put into those books of hours, is really pretty revolutionary in many ways, and yet it is also goes back to very, very close reading and the kind of analysis that has been a tradition in the humanities now for a century and a half. So I don't actually think there's a contradiction. I think one actually supports traditional scholarship in many ways.
Well, thank you all very much for your reflections, and it is really it's been a pleasure to hear you speak and to think about the things that you've raised. There is a really important question for universities as a whole to think about. It's not just about libraries. It is, as we've heard today, about researchers and the production of knowledge, about our professors as teachers and therefore the way in which they disseminate that information to students who have new ways of thinking. We have to have new ways of thinking about our pedagogy. Librarians, course designers, faculty developers, and professors themselves are all now intimately related to each other in that way. We've tried some experiments at McGill with MOOCs in the edX consortium that have been very successful in doing two important things. One is they force professors to think carefully about copyright compliance and to find information that is of high quality that's available on the internet in that fourth revolution. They give us the opportunity then to put the material together in a creative way, making sure that on the team that generates the MOOC, there is a librarian as well as a pedagogue, as well as a professor and a course designer. And the interesting thing that comes out of that as well is that students have taught us through the MOOCs that social media matter to them, and they can matter just as much on campus as off campus. And we took the experiences of the MOOC with 25 or 30,000 students, brought it to a 600-student classroom, and found that the social media worked for them as well. So we're living through a revolution. We should embrace it and not shun it, and we should figure out, thanks to the reflections we've had from our panelists today, figure out ways in which we can have an impact on campus for the things that they discussed, and in particular think about ways in which we can reimagine our libraries. So thank you all very much.
Well, it's my pleasure to thank everybody who was very much involved in this. Tony, our speakers, Larry, Chris, Harriet, and Clifford. It's been delightful for me. I know it was delightful to everyone here. And don't forget that this is streamed. It will be up on our website very soon. Please join me in thanking everyone here, and Tony, too.